This podcast series is brought to you by Hyundai. Hyundai is building a better world for tomorrow by aiming to neutralize CO2 emissions at all stages of production and operation. Hyundai is working toward carbon neutrality by 2045. Learn more at HyundaiUSA.com.
There's no one driver of the transition toward a more sustainable and environmentally responsible auto industry. As we've talked about already, it's corporate initiatives, investors, market forces, even employee demands, all pushing in that same direction. But there's one huge player we haven't quite addressed head-on yet, the government.
Today, America is once again stepping into the leadership role. We will be joining in a partner for the nations in efforts to decarbonize critical sectors across the board.
That was President Joe Biden just 3 months after his inauguration in 2021 during a two-day virtual summit of world leaders meant to set the tone for global cooperation on efforts to address climate change. During the meeting, Biden pledged to cut U.S. greenhouse gas emissions in half from 2005 levels by the end of this decade. As usual, he talked about it through the lens of economic opportunity, including for the auto industry.
For automotive workers, building electric cars, trucks, and buses, skilled workers installing and charging stations to accommodate them throughout our countries.
In that same meeting, Japan announced its pledge to slash emissions by 46% below 2013 levels by 2030. Canada said it would cut at least 40% of its emissions levels from 2005 in the same time frame. Leaders from China, India, and other major economies reiterated earlier pledges. Not every environmental activist was satisfied with the pace laid out in the meeting, but Biden said it was critical to show that every country, even ones that were slow to move on cutting carbon, agreed that climate change was real and that a global response was necessary.
This is a moral imperative, an economic imperative, a moment of peril, but also a moment of extraordinary possibilities.
But this wasn't the first time the U.S. had made bold statements and signaled a major effort to cut carbon emissions. The path has been long, winding, sometimes leading straight off a cliff, but blazed all along by real people doing really hard work. Today on Driving to Zero, we look at the government's role in decarbonizing the auto industry and how the people directly involved feel about the direction we're heading now. I'm Jake Neer with Automotive News. January 2009, just after the inauguration of another new president, Barack Obama, an EPA official by the name of Margot Ogay is outside the White House, as she puts it, haggling with a security guard at the entrance. "I don't see your name," he tells Ogay. She jokes, "Maybe it was deleted during the Bush years." The guard doesn't laugh. Some phone calls are made. She finally gets in. She enters the White House and goes to the East Room, where President Obama is about to sign something monumental in the fight to address climate change.
I mean, if I say that I was just happy, that's not enough.
Ogay was the director of the EPA's Office of Transportation and Air Quality, a job she had held since 1994. She had been working for the agency since 1980. Ogay says concerns were growing among her colleagues over several years about climate change, and they felt more and more strongly that it was their job to help address carbon emissions. And during that time, they had battled with President George W. Bush's White House over those very issues. That culminated when California, in 2004, adopted aggressive regulations on greenhouse gas emissions from new cars and trucks. But it needed EPA approval. It didn't get it.
We were frustrated that President Bush and the administrator of EPA, Steve Johnson, decided for the first time in the history of EPA to deny a California waiver to set their own greenhouse gas emissions standards, despite the extensive data that the state provided to demonstrate that they are meeting the requirements under the Clean Air Act.
to maybe further underscore the frustration of the Bush years, there was a really interesting story that I'm hoping maybe you can share about a certain email that was never opened, an email attachment. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah. So basically, before EPA makes a decision to regulate greenhouse gas emissions, we have to have a scientific document that determines that these pollutants, the greenhouse gases, are pollutants. So we send it to the Office of Management and Budget for the review. And I don't believe legally we had to do it, but we were asked to do it. And they never opened it, because if they open it, then it becomes public, a public document. You as a reporter could have access and start asking questions. So this email was never opened. That's what they said. So we were frustrated, if I have to say. But also we were prepared, because what we have been doing under the President Bush administration is developing the models, designing the data, designing the programs. So when President Obama came, we were ready to go.
So that brings us back to the morning of January 26th, 2009, in the East Room. Oge is there with the EPA's new administrator, Lisa Jackson, and many other high-ranking officials and activists. They're gathered to watch President Obama sign two executive orders. One instructs the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, NHTSA, to finalize corporate average fuel economy standards, better known as CAFE standards, for 2011, and reevaluate the Bush administration's proposal for new standards for 2012 through 2015. The second directed Margot Oge's team to reconsider California's waiver request to set its own greenhouse gas standards for new cars and trucks. Now, before I lose you, yes, even Margot admits those actions probably sound dully bureaucratic. That's how she puts it in her book, Driving the Future. But she says it sets the ball rolling on something really, really significant. She writes, quote, "Something as mundane as approving a waiver would actually be the single biggest step ever taken in the United States toward tackling climate change." That's because it provided a unique opening to enact the first greenhouse gas regulations in U.S. history, taking a set of varying state and federal standards and creating a single unified national program for both carbon emissions and fuel economy standards.
We basically took the California program and we made some changes to address a number of issues that we had at the federal level, and NHTSA came along. It wasn't that simple to say it, came along. But then we went to the president and we said, you know, by May of this year, you can announce that you can have the first greenhouse gas emission standards that ever has happened in this country. So we went beyond what the president was asking us to do. So not only we gave California its waiver, we said, we got some more news for you, Mr. President. It's not just NHTSA, but we can bring everybody together. And the White House agreed.
The White House may have agreed, but how would the industry react? Without commitments from automakers, some of them might file lawsuits. If they don't stop the rule, a prolonged legal battle would at least delay implementation. So Margot, her team, and other federal officials decided to reach out to automakers to hammer out a deal that everyone could get behind.
You know, you need to talk to people. Yes, we're regulating you, but you're not bad. Some of my colleagues at EPA and other offices look at the industry, my God, you know, they're the enemies. You're not the enemies. So you have to treat people with respect. And actually, my team and I went to each car company separately. And we sat down and we said, you know, what can you do? What you cannot do? How much time you need? How much it's going to cost you? And that paid off big time.
It was a very important juncture in not just our broader, you know, carbon neutrality journey, but really for the industry in terms of the start of really having more clarity and more, you know, durability of policy by, you know, taking on the task collectively between industry and government to set standards really on a longer time horizon.
That's Bob Holycross, who's now Ford Motor Company's Chief Sustainability, Environment, and Safety Officer. You might remember him from the last episode.
I was here at Ford and working on those standards at the time, and was a close partner with Margot Ogay and her team, and it was extremely valuable because, you know, everybody had a need, an immediate need at the time because of some of the uncertainty that had come in overall with where the states were going. There were lawsuits at different stages around whether carbon emissions could be regulated under the Clean Air Act. CAFE regulations on the NHTSA side of the ledger were, you know, approaching some challenges with just how they were structured. And we really needed to bring everybody together, all the different stakeholders, to make sure we had something everybody could sign up to and commit to so that we would have that level of certainty that we needed. So everybody came together initially to commit to work together.
According to Margot Ogay's book, each company had its own unique priorities and hangups in the initial talks. General Motors wanted credits for producing flex fuel ethanol vehicles. Chrysler wanted protections for its profitable Jeep Cherokee and other SUVs. Toyota wanted credits for the Prius, despite the fact that it was already well established in the marketplace. Also, remember, this is 2009. Chrysler has declared bankruptcy, GM is careening in that direction, and Ford is also at risk. Margot believes this had a complicated effect on the talks, but ultimately helped the EPA's effort. Chrysler is in the middle of its sell-off and restructuring. It has the fewest carbon-cutting technologies in the pipeline. So Margot says Chrysler seemed a bit lost and wasn't all that helpful in discussions. But she also writes in Driving the Future that maybe the financial calamities, quote, scared them straight, referring to GM and Ford. The Obama administration was working on sending tens of billions of dollars in financial support for American automakers. That, plus the offer to give automakers one national program to follow instead of multiple sets of regulations, made auto executives more cooperative than Margot ever remembered when it came to working with regulators.
I think for the first set of greenhouse gas standards, 2012 to 2016, I think there was a broad agreement among the car manufacturers. They had seen what California was trying to do. They were really happy that we were harmonizing. That to them, that was the biggest issue. They didn't want to deal with three different programs. And I don't blame them. You know, they just want one national program.
Federal officials worked through all of the issues individually with each company and created a national program that would take effect for the 2012 model year. It would last through 2016. It required a fleet-wide average of 35.5 miles per gallon. Now that's CAFE miles per gallon, little asterisk here. An equivalent EPA sticker would read about 27 miles per gallon in 2016. And not every new vehicle would have to meet that. Trucks would continue to have lower requirements than cars. A looming question remained, though. What was going to happen after 2016? To figure that out, Margot and her team went off again to meet with automakers to negotiate a second set of standards for 2017 through 2025. And that would end up being much tougher. By now, it's 2010. Margot and her team are asking automakers to look 15 years into the future. What does any car look like 15 years into the future? I mean, think about that from our perspective in 2023. What does a car look like in 2038? What kind of technology is possible by then? And what kinds of vehicles will be most in demand? The first set of standards could mostly be envisioned using the carbon-cutting technologies already in the pipeline. But this was different. And that's why Bob Holycross says Ford and other automakers wanted something in the agreement that would give them some wiggle room.
There were no guarantees of ultimate success because of how much we depend on what eventually is the market uptake of the different technologies of vehicles.
Among other things, automakers wanted some kind of check-in along the way to gauge the market and state of technology. Administration officials accepted that, adding a midterm review to the deal before the second set of standards would kick in. And after months of painstaking, sometimes contentious talks, they reached a deal. It would require fleet-wide fuel economy of 54.5 miles per gallon by 2025. That's about 40 real-world miles per gallon. It also included incentives to encourage early adoption of advanced carbon-saving technologies, including electric vehicles. President Obama announces the second program alongside 13 smiling auto CEOs and other senior executives. The only holdouts are Volkswagen and Mercedes, because they say it places an unfair burden on makers of passenger cars while allowing special flexibility for manufacturers of heavier light trucks. But getting everyone else on board was a huge win for Margo, the EPA, and the Obama White House. But the 2017 to 2025 program was dealt a death blow with the surprise election of President Donald Trump in 2016. Remember that midterm review that was built into the deal? The Obama administration rushed that process through before Trump's inauguration, hoping to crystallize it before leaving office. It didn't work. The program was one of multiple EPA regulations that Trump rolled back early in his term.
It was a massive power grab. The EPA's regulators were putting people out of jobs by the hundreds of thousands.
Here's Bill Wareham, an EPA assistant administrator under Trump.
What we want is to occupy a sweet spot here where we have good, aggressive standards in place, but not so aggressive that we create other kinds of problems that impose a much greater price on society here.
Instead of defending the program as it was designed, automakers who initially signed on to the deal ended up supporting some sort of rollback. Bob Holycross says the Obama administration's handling of the midterm check-in brought up concerns for Ford.
The way things winded down in the Obama administration and the way the midterm review took place, there were questions in our mind about information that wasn't considered and where the realities were in some elements of how the program was progressing.
I felt betrayed.
Margo says she thought Ford and other automakers exaggerated, even lied to the Trump administration about what the standards would have meant for their companies. But she says that part of the saga serves as an important lesson for current and future regulators.
I don't want to see any other midterm review the way we did it under President Obama. So we agree. We set the regulation. The regulation goes through the process. Industry can sue you, but let's not give another opportunity, another opening to another administration to weaken the standards. That doesn't mean they cannot do it, but it's going to be more challenging.
But she says the biggest takeaways for regulators today and in the future are all about respect for the industry you're regulating and vice versa, and for other agencies.
Data is important, science is important, but relationships and respect, in my view, are the most important. And it takes time. It's easy for us to lock in our scientists and engineers and lawyers, and they can do it, you know, they're experts. But to do it the right way, it takes effort, it takes coordination, it takes time. And one more thing that happened, which is not happening right now, is the way that we did it under Obama. And I'm not suggesting what we did with Obama was the only way to do it, but the coordination between the White House, the Environmental Protection Agency, the Department of Transportation, and even California was absolutely crucial. Again, that takes a lot of work.
As for Ford, Bob Holycross says it felt the Trump administration went too far in its rollback of environmental protections, so it was among a handful of automakers that decided to work with California to follow its standards.
We quickly worked as Ford to, you know, partner with California in particular because of the leadership they had shown in this space and carved out a course independent of how the standards had changed. And that's the same as we talked about earlier, the same pattern that we took for then the initial standards that the Biden administration took when they came in and that we're pursuing now. So yes, there, you know, some different fits and starts as a whole in terms of where these things transition to, but I would just point back to how we ultimately conducted ourselves and stayed consistent with our goals and worked to find a solution independent of the politics.
Okay, so Jamie, we touched on this saga a little bit in the first episode of the series, but these stories from Margot Ogey and Bob Holycross, I think they shed some really interesting light on the complexity and nuance of the situation.
Yeah, regulation, like democracy, it can be a messy business, right? Trying to write rules and hold actual people and organizations accountable, them getting effectively the consent of the governed, right? So it was a very messy process and still left some folks with some hard feelings.
Well, there's another chapter to the story that's actually playing out right now as we speak. Under the Biden administration, the EPA is now working on a new set of carbon emission standards for new cars and trucks. Audrey LaForest is a reporter covering Washington, D.C. for us at Automotive News and has been all over this story. Audrey, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So tell us a little bit about the EPA's new proposal for tailpipe emissions and what it would mean for the industry.
Yeah, absolutely. So earlier this year, the EPA unveiled what it's calling its strictest ever vehicle emission standards for cars and light trucks. And this affects the 2027 to 2032 model years. These new standards, the proposal would require 13% fleet-wide average emission reductions each year and a 56% reduction in average emission target levels from the 2026 model year. So pretty big increases in stringency from what we saw previously. Also to note, if this proposal is finalized, the EPA projects that it could mean electric vehicles, solely battery electric, so not including plug-in hybrid or fuel cell vehicles, but they say that it could mean that solely battery electric vehicles would make up more than half of new vehicle sales by the 2030 model year and two-thirds by 2032. So a pretty massive leap from the current market, with EVs accounting for 9% of new car sales in the U.S. in the second quarter.
And that includes plug-in hybrids, right?
Yeah.
Audrey, can you compare for us this new proposal with the Obama-era EPA and NHTSA programs that were rolled back under President Trump? How far do they go in comparison?
Yeah, and first I want to bring up the rule that was finalized still under Obama, just to show that comparison from where we're jumping with this new proposal. So for the 2023 to 26 model year standards, that required an increase in stringency of about 5 and 10% each model year. That compares with the proposal, as I said, which would require the 13% fleet-wide average emissions reductions. In March 2020, however, under the Trump administration, that administration did roll back Obama standards, requiring only 1.5% annual increases in efficiency through the 2026 model year. And then comparing that with Obama, under his standards, it required about a 5% increase annually. So, you know, under Biden, we're definitely seeing things sort of trying to play catch up here on, you know, some of the rollback that we saw under the Trump administration.
And that brings up an interesting dynamic about not having, again, this one national program. Talk about how the auto industry is reacting to the fact that, you know, they had one program that they were able to follow as a big selling point for getting automakers on board in the first place. And now that's not the case, even with this new plan.
Yeah, the auto industry, basically ever since, you know, the Obama standards, they want to see a return to the one national standard that aligns the EPA's regulation with NHTSA's fuel economy standards and also regulations that are much tougher in California. As, you know, the standards in California, if states adopt those regulations, then, you know, that also affects the auto industry. And with the EPA's current proposal that's on the table, the auto industry also wants them to better sync this up with Biden's 2030 EV sales goal. You know, as I mentioned before, EPA's projections are much higher than that 50% goal that they had already said was a stretch. to get into a little bit of the auto industry's reaction to this current EPA proposal too. They're clear and they say that they do support a transition to EVs. They're committing, you know, more than $100 billion in U.S. investments to support this goal. But they're also pretty harshly criticizing the EPA's proposal. The Alliance for Automotive Innovation, which is, they represent, you know, the major automakers here in the U.S., as well as, you know, some battery suppliers now and other auto suppliers in the U.S. They've called the draft rule essentially a de facto battery electric vehicle mandate. They don't think it's reasonable, and they don't think it's achievable in the time frame. So they're definitely pushing back pretty hard on the EPA's proposal this time around.
So, Audrey, what's going to happen next?
Yeah, so the public comment period for the EPA's proposal closed this past July, and EPA is going to review those comments, maybe take them into consideration. We could see perhaps a weakening of the proposal if they listen to, you know, some of the responses that they're getting from the automakers directly. And EPA is expected to finalize the rule next spring, so we'll see.
Now, before we move on, I wanted to thank Bob Holycross of Ford and Margot Oge for their participation and help with the podcast. And if you want a much more detailed and layered view of what you heard so far on this episode and the history here, it's all in Margot's book, Driving the Future, Combating Climate Change with Cleaner, Smarter Cars. Coming up, we'll look at some other major moves by the U.S. government to decarbonize the auto industry and its products, and GM's former chief economist joins us to talk about what those incentives actually mean for automakers and the economy.
There's still a really powerful channel from gas prices to consumer sentiment to consumption, which is 70% of the economy. And switching to EVs that are powered by a diverse set of fuels that power our electric grid will really break that link.
Elaine Buckberg joins us next on Driving to Zero.
Hyundai's vision, progress for humanity, is based on a determination to ensure universal mobility while supporting a carbon-neutral society, with plans to electrify the entire vehicle lineup and over 20 years of research into hydrogen technology. Hyundai is leading the way for change toward a more sustainable world. Hydrogen, in particular, is a crucial component of Hyundai's carbon neutrality efforts, and it's more than just an alternative fuel source for passenger vehicles. From production, storage, and distribution to hydrogen use in trucks, public transportation, ships, urban air mobility, and beyond, Hyundai is invested in establishing hydrogen as a widely used energy across our entire society. Hyundai is committed to building a better world for tomorrow, and the future of hydrogen has never been more promising. Learn more at HyundaiUSA.com.
Hi, I'm Pete Bigelow, host of Shift, a podcast about mobility from Automotive News. Each week, I bring you a conversation with leaders who are on the cutting edge of transportation, like this one with consultant and strategist Celica Josiah Talbot.
The technologists are forcing themselves in a space that they shouldn't be. And I think the social scientists and politicians are falling down on the job.
To hear more about the new technology and policy reshaping the way people and goods move around, join me on Shift. New episodes each Sunday on autonews.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
The U.S. government's role in decarbonizing the auto industry took a big leap last August.
U.S. President Joe Biden on Tuesday signed into law a massive $430 billion climate, healthcare, and tax bill.
The Inflation Reduction Act invests $369 billion to take the most aggressive action ever in confronting the climate crisis and strengthening our energy security.
The new law triggered a shift from the old $7,500 tax credit for consumers purchasing new electric vehicles to a more complicated one designed to incentivize domestic EV production, reduce reliance on foreign supply chains, and prevent wealthy buyers from getting a discount. Elaine Buckberg was General Motors' chief economist from 2018 until March 2023. In that role, she was responsible for assessing how economic developments around the world would affect the corporation, and she gave leaders advice on all kinds of economic policy issues. Elaine also headed long-term forecasting of auto segments and vehicles, and that included forecasting and analysis of EV adoption. Buckberg is now a senior fellow with the Salata Institute for Climate and Sustainability at Harvard.
Elaine Buckberg, welcome to Driving to Zero. Thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Your resume is so interesting. You've done so many things related to what we're talking about on this podcast in terms of your work at GM, also in the Obama administration, the Brattle Group. But I think let's start with what your sense is right now, especially when it comes to how the U.S. government is trying to incentivize, in many ways, EV adoption. We've talked quite a bit about the Inflation Reduction Act. Overall, what does the strategy look like in your mind, and is it something you think will work?
First, yes. I think the wide range of large dollar financial incentives to EV adoption and other forms of net zero transportation will really drive uptake over the next decade. And I think that this was something that was already in motion between the offerings becoming more perfect substitutes for internal combustion engine vehicles, but the financial incentives make it an easier decision for the customer, make it a more profitable decision for the manufacturer, and also will make progress towards facilitating the public charging infrastructure that is essential to make EVs a primary vehicle for everyone and work for every use case.
Let's dig down a little bit more into the automaker side of this. As chief economist of GM, you saw sort of a lot of the calculations that go with these kinds of things. When an automaker such as GM that has manufacturing here in the United States and has supply chain here in the United States, what is the calculation that they make? What do those conversations look like, and what is the outcome?
That's a great question. And a complicated one. So first of all, I think it says this EV market's going to be much bigger in any given year than we previously thought, because the EV tax credit to consumers and the commercial tax credit help reduce that price differential between EV and ICE and bring them closer to parity or to parity much sooner. And that's a big motivator to go out and be more aggressive about getting early market share to be a big player in the future EV market. Secondly, the production tax credits, the grants to suppliers help bring down costs. And so the combination of being able to get more demand at any price because of what you're doing for consumer and businesses and bringing down the cost side with subsidies is really powerful in terms of what the profitability looks like of manufacturing, as well as the volumes. And it's worth noting that Paul Jacobson, who's the CFO of GM, said at the end year 2022 earnings call that he thought the impact of the production tax credit was in the range of, I believe it was $3,000 to $5,000 per vehicle. That's over and above the impact of the EV tax credit, the consumer and the commercial tax credits.
That's significant. I mean, we tend to use sort of the rough rule of thumb that a comparable EV costs $10,000 more to make than an ICE vehicle. I don't know if GM would approve of that rule of thumb, but that's what most of the analysts have kind of ballparked. So if you think, you know, $7,500 on the consumer side gets you most of that way, or three quarters of the way. But if you're also getting $3,000 to $5,000 on the production side, it almost seems like it could be a better business.
Right. And I think that's so important because you saw that Tesla, of course, ran losses for a long time and then became highly profitable. And you all write the trade press, you read what the analysts are saying. And there were lots of questions about whether they long-standing traditional automakers could make it in the EV space, including what would happen to their profitability with these big investments and how long that could be sustained. And this just improves that equation. At the same time, you've got other positive forces, like a continued reduction in battery costs and rising volumes. And both of those should help reduce the manufacturing costs more over time. Happy to dig in there more.
Well, one of the things that's always stood out to me about the IRA is the cliff at the end. You know, it goes through 2032, and that's it. And of course, a new program could be implemented after that, just like we had the original EV tax credits and the GM and Tesla exhausted, and then we got these new ones under IRA. But do you believe, and do your models show, or do GM's models show that that's enough? You know, if a good 10 years, 2032, then we have maybe true cost parity?
I think that actually pretty much all the projections that existed before the IRA said you'd get to cost parity then or earlier. Mm.
Okay.
So at that point, you're already at cost parity. Moreover, the Inflation Reduction Act, as well as other regulatory measures through CAFE and GHG and similar stuff around the world, also mean that by the time you're at 2032, the offerings in the market will overwhelmingly be an EV, with the possible exception of really heavy-duty vehicles, like heavy-duty pickups and maybe things that are truly in the medium-duty to heavy-duty and large truck categories. There aren't going to be a lot of internal combustion engine offerings, I don't think, in the market for you to select at that point in time.
Hmm. You don't see
and it's just gonna
even
drive
full-size pickups and full-size SUVs?
Maybe full-size, a heavy-duty pickup. I mean, some of the analysis we did when I was at GM was what percentage of at least light-duty pickup owners use cases with towing and hauling and the distance they drive could be solved with an EV. And we were coming up with percentages in excess of 90% that you could sort of, as long as you charged at your destination before turning around and going home, you're good, even if you're towing. So it's a pretty rare use case that wouldn't be satisfied by an EV with, say, 300 miles of range. And it's definitely true that consumers don't buy for their everyday use case. They want to buy for their extreme use case. They want the SUV that can do their vacation when they bring their entire family and their friends and their luggage. And even if there are two cars in the house and the household does one road trip a year, they want to buy an EV that could do a road trip because they might. Mm-hmm. But they become more and more perfect substitutes. You have better range. You have batteries that are more energy efficient and more energy dense. So you can put more battery in a vehicle at any given price and without disrupting what the vehicle's going to look like. You will have more charging infrastructure and fast charging infrastructure so that that becomes ever less of a concern, hopefully by 2032. It becomes a trivial concern and people are a little more used to the fact that it takes a little bit longer than gas. Or maybe the technology has improved so much with breakthroughs we can't anticipate today or don't know when they'll happen that it won't.
Elaine, you know, having served as GM's chief economist from 2018 to just recently this year, I know that you were involved in forecasting and analyzing the pace of EV adoption. Were there forecasts and analysis on both sides of the Inflation Reduction Act? Were you able to quantify sort of how the forecast shifted before and after?
Yeah, I ran GM's forecasting of EV adoption as well of individual vehicles. And definitely the Inflation Reduction Act boosted our forecast of EV adoption across the board in any year. And in addition, the Bipartisan Infrastructure Law or Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act and the charging funding embedded there also contributed because charging was an important input into that model as well.
One of the things, and I'm thinking about a piece you just posted that I only got to look at a little bit, but I know like there are people with, I don't know if they're quite doomsday scenarios, but there are a lot of concerns people have that there's the cost of the vehicles, there's the cost of the charging, there's the sourcing of the charging. Are we putting more burden on the economy in trying to decarbonize? And I think you were writing recently that, in fact, you can add economic stability and confidence for consumers through greater EV adoption. Am I getting that right?
Yes, absolutely. So actually, the EV transition should make the U.S. economy more resilient. Why? Because the U.S. economy is still vulnerable to swings in oil prices. Mm-hmm. And everyone driving a vehicle is affected when gas prices change. And even though the U.S. economy is a small net exporter of oil and oil products at this point, there's still a really powerful channel from gas prices to consumer sentiment to consumption, which is 70% of the economy. And switching to EVs that are powered by a diverse set of fuels that power our electric grid will really break that link. And so I think that's really important in terms of reducing recession risk. Now, there are a whole bunch of questions around EV supply chains. And some people would say, oh, are we just trading off lithium risk, for oil risk? But the answer is that that would not possibly have the same magnitude of effect. Because if lithium or cobalt or some important battery material were to go up in price, important at that point in time, that would only impact new car buyers at that point in time, not every single person who owns a vehicle. And that's a much smaller impact on the economy. And we've learned in recent years that people can defer their purchases if they have to. And moreover, we've also seen that battery chemistries can change over time in response to relative scarcity or problems with the supply chain, right? Classic examples, cobalt, where it's a question of clean and ethical supply chains. And so Tesla went to a zero cobalt battery in some of their vehicles. GM reduced cobalt by 70%. Are there challenges around supply chains? Absolutely happy to dig in this more, but I also think that we're seeing supply responses as well as demand responses, like changing battery chemistries, that will help smooth that path.
I mean, with your studies at GM, and you're looking not just at, I know GM has done a lot of work to secure the minerals needed through the middle of this decade, and of course, we'll try to stay ahead of the curve like that. But, of course, there's a lot of other automakers, and there are new ones. Everyone's got big projections. And, of course, the Inflation Reduction Act is very much geared around onshoring, reshoring, you know, domesticating the supply chain for batteries, which, of course, China's been working on for a long time. It can be done. Do you believe there's enough of all the critical minerals that we can get in North America or from friendly nations, and can we build up the refining capacity that will really onshore this value chain?
So first of all, this is a challenging area, but one, again, I think that the minerals are out there in the earth, and we're trying to de-risk our supply chain with China. I don't know if anyone thinks that we're going to have zero China content across all EVs globally. Certainly, the Inflation Reduction Act encourages critical minerals and battery raw materials to get to very low percentages on critical minerals and no battery components from China over time to get the tax credit. There'll be EVs that don't get the tax credit. But again, you can see the supply responses. You can see efforts to extract and refine in North America. You can see big ramp-ups in production and refining in different countries that are not China. I think an interesting one is Indonesia has gone from being a trivial nickel producer to being number two in the world last year. Now, at number two, they were at something like 7%, but they had been at something like 2% just a few years before. And that was actions to get mines ready that doubtless started years ago, coming to fruition. Indonesia and Malaysia, I believe, want to refine more of the metals coming out of their country so they get more of the value chain, not just produce them, but that helps shift refining to places other than China. So is it easy? No. Are we seeing progress? Absolutely. And again, there's that potential for battery chemistry changes that will move battery raw material demands away from scarce things. There's just so much research effort that's going into batteries today, public, private, around the world. And you know that that research effort is looking at how do we move away from the most scarce things? How do we achieve that holy grail of solid state with faster charging and greater safety? And I used to point to the Manhattan Project and say, you know, look what massive resources do. Look at COVID vaccines, something that everyone said would be impossible to do in 18 months got done in under a year. Massive resources produce breakthroughs.
On that note, what additionally needs to happen from the government's role in all of this, if anything, to get there?
I think the government's done a great deal. It's moved very aggressively with industrial policy in a way that hasn't happened in many decades. I think that the biggest opportunity now is to think very carefully about permitting. Permitting, whether you're talking about mines and getting mines approved, or you're talking about permitting to install EV chargers. This is a complicated issue, and our permitting rules, you know, date back, like started developing in the 1970s with greater recognition of the damage we were doing to the environment. But I think there's recalibration that's possible there. And I think if that can be done in a bipartisan way, that would be constructive legislation.
Now, I assume there's environmental risks with that as well, though.
There are, and you're always trying to balance risks between potential environmental costs versus alternative costs, right? And if you're trying to, for example, reduce environmental costs from climate change, from greenhouse gases, you've got to weigh different kinds of environmental costs about that. There are people who do this analysis. It's tough. You're weighing different kinds of important things, but I think there's real potential in this area.
Is there anything else that you want to add before we end off here?
No, this has been great. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely.
Okay, well, I'm back with Jamie and Audrey now. You know, guys, the Inflation Reduction Act could probably be an entire limited series podcast all on its own.
No doubt.
Yeah, but what are some of the most important things, Audrey, that you think the audience should know about how it's affecting the auto industry today?
Yeah, I mean, first and foremost is really just the tax credits that are available to consumers and also companies in the Inflation Reduction Act. I know the EV tax credits specifically have been such a focus in the media, in what companies, automakers, suppliers, policymakers are discussing and arguing about in a way. You know, we saw a major revamping of the tax credit for new EV purchases known as 30D. There's quite a few restrictions in order to get that $7,500 tax credit. It put new caps on buyer income, on MSRP, and it also set new restrictions that took effect earlier this year on EV battery sourcing. So battery components and then the critical minerals that go into the batteries. And that's made it much, much tougher for vehicles to qualify for the credit. We saw, you know, a pretty major reduction in the number of vehicles that are eligible. I want to say it's, if it's not 20, then it might be less than that now. And the rules get tougher next year when the foreign entity of concern provision takes effect for battery components. And we're still waiting on guidance from Treasury as in terms of how strictly that will even be implemented. And that's just one of the tax credits.
Well, right. And it's interesting, as you said, the rules get tougher, but we're going to see so many more models, you know, built in North America, so many more EVs coming to market, hopefully with a clearer picture of what the battery rules are going to be. So maybe more vehicles will end up qualifying. It's definitely going to be interesting how that plays out.
Yeah, absolutely. And that is, you know, one of the big themes stemming from the Inflation Reduction Act is just how much of an effect it's had on this restructuring, redrawing of supply chains here in the U.S. Because, yes, the administration and Congress are trying to potentially drive EV adoption here, but they also want to ensure that we have that manufacturing capacity and the EV battery supply chain here in the U.S., you know, sort of trying to loosen that chokehold that China has on the EV battery supply chain. I think another tax credit that I'd like to bring up is the 45X Advanced Manufacturing Production Tax Credit that is really quite a game changer for battery companies and in some cases for the automakers, especially as they're partnering with a lot of these battery makers. That credit specifically is uncapped. So it's a pretty big incentive, you know, to open up like a battery plant here in the U.S. and even for the critical minerals. I know there's credits available for that part of it too.
I've heard people in the industry and investors, you know, talk about how, you know, with the Inflation Reduction Act and 45X and the other components, it's actually become the lowest cost place to build batteries and EVs, which is a tremendous turnaround. You know, I mean, I know some people are uncomfortable with the government having such a big role in shaping the industry. You know, America has a capitalist economy. We tend to think that the professionals and the people with the money should decide how to invest it, but the government can influence that. They're influencing in a big way now because, as you said, I mean, China leaned into EVs ages ago. They're far ahead of us. It's sort of like there's China, there's Tesla, and then there's the rest of the auto industry well behind them. And it's this huge funding to come back and be competitive. And that's what we're seeing in the Inflation Reduction Act is this sort of 10-year investment, massive investment to try to go toe-to-toe with China and Europe.
Yeah, and you know, that's probably one thing that Republicans and Democrats can't agree on is, you know, finding ways to reduce reliance on China or even Russia for that matter for the critical minerals processing and whatnot. I think the steps to get there, to do that, to reduce that reliance are different between Democrats and Republicans. And we're kind of seeing that play out, especially here in Washington. You know, there's also been, you know, just quite a bit of criticism on Biden's EV policies and whatnot. But yeah, they can definitely agree on, you know, they want to make sure that the U.S. is the leader in this industry and whatnot.
Audrey LaForest, reporter for Automotive News covering Washington, D.C. for us. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, so much of what we've been talking about depends heavily on one thing, technology. And that's what we're talking about next time on Driving to Zero, the tech breakthroughs that could propel the industry toward a carbon-free future.
We want this technology to change the world. That's the fundamental vision for this company. And it's really about when and how we can do that.
Driving to Zero is a podcast from Automotive News, original music and sound design by Sam Bobian. We got additional help from Kellen Walker and Alicia Anderson. I'm Jake Neer.
And I'm Jamie Butters.
We'd love it if you could give us a like, review, and follow the podcast to make sure you catch the next episode of Driving to Zero.